Today on Vox Talks, the history of public debt accounting. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. A decade ago, the European sovereign debt crisis focused our attention on countries that reportedly had unsustainable ratios of debt to GDP. But how was the debt part of the ratio calculated, and how consistently has it been calculated over the years? Well, on both these questions, your assumptions might be a lot simpler and less interesting than the truth. The surprisingly rich story of public debt accounting is the focus of a new CEPR discussion paper, and Eric Monnet of the Paris School of Economics and the CEPR is one of the authors. Welcome to Vox Talks, Eric.
Hi, Tim. Nice to be here.
The sovereign crisis in the EU, it did highlight, didn't it, that debt in the euro area has been calculated using some unusual accounting assumptions. Can you give me some examples of that?
I would not say really unusual, but clearly it might be debatable. And it's definitely not a natural accounting method that should be taken as at the truth or should be taken as single best indicator. So how is it debatable and where does it come from? So debt in the sense of the Maastricht Treaty, which has passed in the early 1990s, actually anticipated a lot of definitions of public debt which are now widely used by other international institutions. So in that sense, I would say that the debt in the sense of Maastricht that is used in the EU is quite common actually and can be quite similar to other institutions. But yet, there are some principles that might be debatable. So the first one is that it's a definition of gross debt. So it means that it's not a net debt. There is no subtraction between the assets and the liabilities of the state. And it does not include contingent debt, contingent liabilities. That means guarantees that the government can provide to some institutions. So this is the first principle, which is very important. The second one is that it's a general government debt. It's not only the central government. It includes all the state bodies, local, regional, and it's consolidated. And the third principle is that it's nominal. It means that it's calculated as it is issued by the state. It's not a market value. And for sure, it can make sometimes some big difference.
When we have adjustments like this, does it give us a clue that debt to GDP ratios for different countries or comparing at different times maybe aren't comparing like with like?
There are good reasons for using comparable measures to use benchmarks. But the principle of using benchmark is that actually you throw out some very important countries' peculiarities that you don't want to appear in these benchmark statistics because they will bias the statistics of one country. But sometimes this bias might be quite interesting. So this is one of the reasons why if you look actually at the publications by international institutions, at the OECD, at the IMF, of the BIS, most of the time, if you look at the details in all the documents that they wrote to discuss the construction of public debt, they all say that there is no single best indicator for public debt statistics and that you will find many different debt to GDP ratios depending on whether, for example, you include regional debt or these contingent liabilities. So we can take some examples. One which is actually probably the most well-known is whether you include the debt of the regions in the federal state. The debt of Canada, for example, Canada is a very federalist country. And if you look only at the central government, rather than the general government, the debt to GDP ratio dropped by 40 percentage points. So it might be huge. So whether we should take into account this regional debt to study the Canada public debt, it's still an open issue. It depends on what you are interested at and what are the political economy issues you're interested in. The other issue, which was especially relevant for the euro area during the financial crisis of 2008-2009 and the subsequent public debt crisis, is the issue of contingent liabilities, meaning all the guarantees that states provided to banks, for example, to financial institutions to avoid the crisis. These are public. I'm not here telling secrets that are hidden from the public. I mean, if you look at Eurostat, I mean, they provide what is supposed to be the benchmark measure of public debt, but there are also many documents on these contingent liabilities. You can find on that the statistics on the contingent liabilities and non-performing loans, for example, for EU member states. And you will see, for example, that for Finland, these guarantees provided to the financial sector sectors, they are 30% of GDP today. And for some other countries, it's totally minor. So this is an issue that should be discussed, you know, because these contingent liabilities are some work, for example, by the IMF have shown, sometimes they can bring very high fiscal costs, especially during crisis. And maybe if I should give a last example, which is probably even more relevant for today, because the two main issues today are related to climate risk or also to a rising public debt after the COVID crisis. And if you think about contingent liabilities in a world of very high risk of climate disasters, I mean, this issue might come back at the forefront of the scene because at some point, the states have to provide guarantees to many, many activities because this climate risk might be very big. For sure, the financial institutions looking at the debt might take that into account. And related to the other point on the current high debt level following the crisis, we all know that the purchase of public debt by central bank has been very, very important to make this public debt sustainable. And today, almost one third of the public debt is held by the central bank in advanced economy and in the European Union. So should we count this debt as public debt? This is a very interesting question, and the answer is not obvious. And as we speak today, I remember a note published last week by the largest wealth manager in Europe, Amundi, saying that actually in this research note, they were discussing the fact that maybe this debt held by the central bank should be taken out of the public debt statistics for financial institutions looking at debt to GDP ratio. And actually, it could be meaningful because for sure, this debt is not something that is going to depend on financial actors.
This is a history paper because you're looking at three time periods for how debt has been reported. And we start at the beginning going way back before World War One. Clearly, at this time, there's no national statistics agencies. So who is adding up what these debts are at this time?
So sometimes government themselves, they published some statistics on their debt. But most of the time, it was a financial press that was taking some numbers and trying to publish some series about different countries. So all of this was debt issued on the market. But the conditions of the issuance of debt varied widely. So if you look at the financial press, you realize that from one year to another, there are big shifts in the definitions. And one which is interesting example of China. And if you look at the financial press in the late 19th century, you see that every year, I mean, they change the definition of the Chinese public debt because one year they think that it was relevant to include the war indemnity that was supposed to be paid to Japan. And at some point, they decided that it was no longer relevant. So you see that this figures very widely. In the paper we quote a previous paper by Peter Lindell and Peter Morton, written in the 1980s, where they clearly say that it's obviously that the sources written by financial journalists were not written for subsequent scholars because the definitions are not consistent at all. So there are some more consistent statistics, though, that were based by some economists who were trying to get these sources from the press and building some more consistent series in the 19th century, or even by some banks. When an example is actually the French banks, which were very important banks at the time, the Crédit Lyonnais, which constructed a lot of these public debt series from very, very various sources. And Marc Flandre, for example, an economic historian, has discovered these sources. And these sources are still widely used. I mean, in the main databases by Reinhardt and Rogoff, for example, this is where the data are coming from.
Why did they put so much effort into it? What were these statistics used for at this point? And I guess what they were used for must have also influenced what they decided to put into them.
Exactly. And this is something we emphasize a lot in the paper, that when we use these historical statistics, it's very important to understand who were constructing them and for what purposes they were used. And for the 19th century, they were built by investors. So investors trying to look at the financial health of different countries. So they reflect the view of investors. And in these views, there were very interesting debates on, you know, what is the main interesting statistical representations for financial investors. And we quote several economists writing during this period. And actually, most of them were saying that what should be the most consistent definition was not gross debt, as we use today, but net debt, meaning that it's subtracting the assets of the state from the liabilities. Because the idea for an investor, and especially a financial investor of this period, where, you know, it was sometimes possible to intervene in one country to save the assets of a state, it was really this idea of net debt, because you can always save the assets of one country to reimburse the debt.
whizzing through history now, after World War One, we have much larger public sectors. Did that force a rethink on how we calculate public debt and what we use those statistics for?
After World War One, there are two very important issues regarding this public debt and the statistics. The first one is the issue of war debt. So obviously, war debt existed before. After World War One, there was like all these reparations that were put in place, and there was many like conferences at the international level trying to solve the issue of reparations and war debt. So again, this issue of war reparations creates a lot of difficulties in the statistics, because at some point, should we take into account that the country has defaulted on the foreign loans or not? And for war reparations, it's very, very tricky. So there were many different numbers, figures published in the interwar, but the issue is not solved today. I mean, there was a very interesting recent paper by Mariana Astori and Michele Flatiani on Italy and the public debt of Italy, where they provide completely new statistics. So it's really recent, and we're still rediscovering how to calculate Italian public debt for the interwar period. And it's especially linked to this what are called sinking funds, which are the sinking funds were designed by the state to reimburse a part of the debt. So usually their revenue were coming from special taxes. So do we include these sinking funds in the official debt or not? It's a very open issue, and it's completely changed the numbers if you look at it. The second important issue regarding public debt after World War I is, as you said, is the fact that the state are becoming bigger, and especially that there are more and more intervention of the state in the financial system. And especially, a lot of states created public credit institutions to reconstruct the economies after the war. And these public credit institutions, they lend to the state. So they own some public debt, either some public debt that were issued on the market, or sometimes these are just direct loans or even deposits at the treasury. So how do you account for all these potential financial leakages between different institutions that are mostly public institutions? This was something which was very debated during the interwar period, and which was still a very important issue after World War II, because economists and statisticians at that time, they realized that big part of the debt now was no longer issued on markets. On the market, they were not owned by financial investors, but actually they were owned by different bodies of the state. So do we consolidate or not this kind of debt? And so this was a big issue, and it led a lot of economists and statisticians to think about constructing total balance sheet of the state, when you can, you know, see whether you should or not consolidate some of this debt. And in the paper, we talk about what was, we think, the most impressive attempt to build such a total balance sheet of the state. It was an attempt by the League of Nations, but it comes just before the Second World War. It was in 1938, and so it was eventually a failed attempt, mostly because of the wars.
As you say, we're still trying to construct accurate estimates of what the public debt was in Italy at this time. Does the fact that the League of Nations didn't have time to get its balance sheet effort right, and that we're still revising these figures, mean that these attempts to come up with some standard definition of comparable public debt, was that a failure at this time?
I will give two reasons why this effort did not fully succeed. The first one is that the attention shifted to reconstruction of the countries after the war, and the issue of public debt was not as important as it used to be. The second is that statisticians realized that it's very difficult to build this consistent balance sheet of the state and with assets and liabilities. And I think it's a kind of ongoing topic that we described in the paper, is that at different points in history, people always think that the most consistent definition of public debt should be a net debt, when you can really compare the assets and the liabilities of the state. It was the case for financial investors and economists in the late 19th centuries, and it becomes the case for actually very different reasons for some statisticians and economists in the 1930s and 1940s. But at this time, they also realized that it was extremely difficult to build this total wealth, you know, these total assets and total liabilities, because it involves many, many institutions. And how do you account for all this? For example, nationalized corporations. And in many countries after the war, I mean, a lot of key corporations were nationalized. And how do you count the debt of nationalized firms? How do you put that in the total balance sheet of the state? And at some point, they realized that it was an effort that was, you know, completely too big, I mean, just for statisticians.
You mentioned that after the war, then attention shifted elsewhere, but I would have thought that after Bretton Woods, then knowing about levels of public debt would have been a priority. Why didn't that happen?
It was not partly because of the war reparations were not a big problem after World War II compared to World War I, and it was on purpose. I mean, it has been decided that, for example, Germany would not pay an important reparation, that the mistake of the post-World War I would not be repeated. Contrary to what had been the role of the League of Nations in the interwar period, focusing a lot on these reparations, the new role of the IMF or the UN after World War II was not mostly to deal with these war reparations, because there were no longer war reparations. And the second issue was that, as I said, the marketable public debt clearly decreased. I mean, if you look at all the statistics of the composition of public debt in the 1940s, in the 1950s, you see that debt became mostly held by domestic public institutions. Sometimes it was the central banks. Most of the time, these were domestic banks or domestic public credit institutions. So in that case, it was no longer a big threat for government, because these were not like the markets that were owning the debt. And it's only in the 1960s that some emerging markets like India and Brazil experienced again some public debt crises. But for most of what we'll call today the OECD countries, after Bretton Woods, public debt was not an issue, especially marketable public debt.
Today, public debt levels are rarely out of the headlines, and they're used by economists and bankers alike as a benchmark for comparing countries. They're used by credit ratings agencies as well. Are we in a position, though, to say that public debt accounting is now sufficiently harmonized across these countries?
As you say, there have been tremendous efforts since the 1980s to harmonize the statistics across countries. So it really started with the Latin American debt crisis in the early 1980s. And then international organizations, especially the IMF, started to produce manuals, methods to compute public debt and compare them across countries. And as you said before, I mean, it was a big change because this kind of common methodology have been used for trade statistics, GDP, since the 1950s, but not for public debt. It's only in the 1980s that it started. And it started only for external debt, foreign debt, because it was one of the main issues of this Latin American debt crisis in the 1980s. And it's actually later in the 1990s and still in the 2000s that this issue of comparing not only foreign debt, but total public debt really came back at the forefront. And for this, the European definition of the Maastricht debt was very important. So I would say that today, the public debt statistics produced by the international organizations, World Bank, IMF, OECD, are really well harmonized. So in that sense, clearly there have been a huge progress in the last 30 years. But then the question is, does it make sense to harmonize the data like this? So it makes sense to compare. But again, what is interesting, if you look in the detail at all of the documents published by these international institutions, so OECD, the BIS, when they construct their government debt statistics, they all emphasize very clearly there is no single best definition of public debt. And depending on what you're looking at, you might use one definition or another definition. So the harmonized definition is not always the best one to use.
Now, for economists who are looking back at these very long time series of public debt that have been constructed now, a lot of us are, what's your advice on which ones to use or which ones to trust, which assumptions to make when you are using them?
First, it's very important to understand what is inside the public debt statistics that one is using, because the definitions change a lot. Whether it's central government debt, whether it's a general government debt, for example, is a big issue. It's first very important to understand, you know, what is the definition of statistics that is used, whether it's marketable public debt, non-marketable. And for this, we give some hints in the paper. I will also recommend a recent paper by Ali Abbas and Rogoff, published by the IMF, which is called A Guide to Sovereign Debt Data, which is very clear about, you know, the definition of the data that appear in the main data sets that are now available online, produced by an international organization. So first, you know, understand what are the statistics. Second is to ask whether the definition that appear in these data sets is relevant for the analysis, so I mean for the subject under study. So sometimes, for example, taking into account these contingent liabilities will be key. If we go back to the European crisis after 2008, I mean, you cannot really avoid the fact that these contents and liabilities, these guarantees provided by the state to the financial systems, had a very important effect on the perceptions of investors and on the political debate within countries. And so this is one of the conclusion of our chapter, and more generally a conclusion of the book in which this chapter appears. So it's a book called The World of Public Debt, edited by Nicolas Barrère and Nicolas Delannan. And this book provides many specific cases of public debt crisis, of public debt construction in many different countries. And you see that in some cases, it will be more relevant to look at some regional debt, sometimes at a central debt, sometimes at the foreign debt. So it really depends on our cases. The last advice I will give, because it's something that I think is quite often forgotten by economists, that for a long time in history, public debt was not issued on the market. So sometime, which is probably the most widely known case, public debt was war reparations. So it was indemnity from one country to another. But also there have been all these issues of public debt that were owned by public institutions. So whether corporations or financial institutions or central bank. And we still know actually very little on how it did work, you know, because it does not mean that there was no conflict within the state. And we still think that there are still a lot to understand on this issue. And it's especially relevant for today, as I said, that we face a situation of a high share of public debt is now held by the central banks. So what is the political meaning of this?
There is so much more that we could talk about now. And the message is to read the paper, because there's a lot in it to think about. But thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much, Tim.
That paper is called The History of Politics of Public Debt Accounting, and authors Eric Monet and Blaise Trong-Loy. And it is discussion paper 15347. Now, as Eric mentioned, if this has whet your appetite for some more reading on public debt, then it is a chapter in forthcoming book called A World of Public Debt's A Political History. And the editors are Barrière and Lalonde, and that will be published by Palgrave Macmillan. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you'll never miss an episode. And remember, 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.